content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the April 7th, 2017 issue of The Week magazine. The cover this week shows Donald Trump and Paul Ryan standing side by side on a grassy hill. President Trump has his hands up, like, why couldn't you do this? And Paul Ryan has his shoulders shrugged with his hands down, like, I don't know. And then on the hill behind them, there's a tree and a bus with the Republican elephant on it that has just smashed into the tree. Tires everywhere, smoke coming out of the engine compartment. And the headline says, "The GOP crackup, why Trump and Ryan's Obamacare repeal bill crashed and burned." And with that, we'll go to the main stories and how they were covered. The GOP's failed Obamacare repeal. What happened? President Donald Trump and White House Republicans were embroiled in a bitter blame game this week after intra-party disagreements forced humiliated GOP leaders to abandon their long-promised health care bill just 17 days after unveiling it. The brainchild of House Speaker Paul Ryan, the American Health Care Act would have eliminated the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate, which imposes financial penalties on those without insurance. Replaced its income-based subsidies with smaller age-based tax credits, and reversed the law's Medicaid expansion. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimated that these changes would have reduced the deficit but increased the number of Americans without insurance by 24 million by 2026. In the Republican-controlled House, Ryan Care prompted fierce resistance from two GOP factions. Moderates concerned over its impact on seniors and Medicaid recipients, and the Freedom Caucus, a group of about 30 hardline conservatives who objected to the bill's continued use of federal dollars to subsidize individuals' health care. After days of offering concessions and trying to cajole lawmakers into backing the bill, Trump gave Freedom Caucus members a final take-it-or-leave-it ultimatum last Thursday. When they and at least a dozen moderates refused to budge, Ryan pulled the bill the next day. The president's spokesman said Trump left everything on the field in its efforts to pass the legislation. Trump himself initially blamed Democrats and said the opposition party would agree to a beautiful deal when Obamacare explodes. But he later directed his ire at the Freedom Caucus, saying its members had snatched defeat from the jaws of victory and saved Planned Parenthood and Obamacare. Trump did not blame Ryan explicitly, but did encourage his Twitter followers to watch a Fox News show that began with the host, Jeanine Pirro, calling for the speaker's resignation. "I have never seen an administration as incompetent," said Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. "So much for the art of the deal." Ryan acknowledged that his party had come up short, adding, "We're going to be living with Obamacare for the foreseeable future." But Republican leaders and the White House this week revived negotiations on health care legislation on hopes of finding a workable compromise. What the editorial said: "What an astonishing display of political incompetence," said the New York Times. "Republicans have spent 7 years promising to repeal Obamacare, yet when they finally got their chance, they submitted a heartless turkey of a bill that was supported by just 17% of voters. As for the supposedly great deal maker in the Oval Office, Trump proved completely ineffectual at bringing lawmakers into line. The failure of Trump-Ryan Care is good for the country. The bill would have left millions unable to afford insurance, and millions more with higher health care costs. But it is truly humiliating for the Republican leadership. For once, the media dirge is right about the GOP defeat, said the Wall Street Journal. This was a major blow for the Trump administration, the Republican Party, and the cause of reforming and limiting government. But there's no question who bears responsibility for this debacle. The Freedom Caucus. They haughtily dismiss the bill as Obamacare light, but their rule or ruin strategy has essentially enshrined the Obamacare status quo. What the columnist said, Trump won the presidency boasting about his negotiating prowess, said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times. What went wrong? Well, the president showed an appalling lack of interest in the bill's details. Forget about the little stuff, he reportedly told Freedom Caucus holdouts, and never sold the bill to the public. With Trump's approval ratings hovering at record lows and the bill itself pulling horribly, he couldn't charm or bully Republican lawmakers into supporting it. They clearly fear their voters more than they fear him. No one could have saved this slapdash bill, said Harold Pollack in Politico.com. Ryan had the chance to craft legislation consistent with Trump's economic populist rhetoric. Instead, he tried to rush through a politically toxic mess that stripped low-income Americans of health care in order to enact $600 billion in tax cuts for the wealthy. This was a failure of policy and legislature strategy. Things that were supposed to be Ryan's special sauce, not of tactics. Blaming Ryan is a cop-out, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com. Trump proclaimed during the campaign that it will be so easy to get rid of Obamacare. His true believers insisted there was nothing he couldn't do with his Jedi-like negotiating skills and gift for winning. Now those same loyalists claim he was tricked by Ryan and betrayed by the Freedom Caucus. The truth is that Trump isn't the omnicompetent miracle worker that his fans thought he was. There's plenty of blame to go around for the utterly disgraceful failure to repeal Obamacare, said Philip Klein in the Washington Examiner. Nearly every Republican has doggedly campaigned on that pledge through four election cycles, with great success. In stark contrast to Democrats, who spent 13 months painstakingly crafting and building support for the Affordable Care Act, Republicans slapped together a bill in a few weeks, then threw in the towel at the first setback. It's a pathetic abdication of duty. What's next? Trump wants to bounce back with a big legislative win. Two, in fact, said Eric Levitz in nymag.com. The president's current thinking is to move forward with both tax reform and infrastructure spending at the same time and get the Democrats to buy into the job-creating spending on roads and bridges. The former businessman probably understands the tax codes better than he does health care, said Rich Lowry in the New York Post. But tax reform requires painful trade-offs that could further exacerbate intra-party divisions. Trump and Republicans will have to devote much more time and effort to that issue than they did to health care. Still, they can't perform much worse. Our controversy of the week, the GOP. Can the party of no learn to govern? This was supposed to be in the easy part, said Zeke Miller in Time.com. With President Trump in the White House and Republicans in control of both houses of Congress, the GOP should have had no trouble repealing the Affordable Care Act, as they had voted 50 times to do while President Obama was in office. Instead, the repeal and replace effort collapsed last week in a humiliating defeat for Trump and House Speaker Paul Ryan, raising a fundamental question. Can this Republican Party find a way to govern? It's doubtful, said Joan Walsh in TheNation.com. Last week revealed a deep fissure in the GOP between moderates and the far-right Freedom Caucus and exposed Trump himself as an incompetent pusher with the limited powers of persuasion. The bigger problem is with the party as a whole. Having been marinated in Obama hatred for 8 years, the modern GOP is less a political party than a collection of grievances, bound together by a shared loathing of liberals, cultural elites, and government itself. As even Ryan admitted, being against things was easy to do. Now we actually have to get people to agree with each other. There's no denying that Republicans had a bad week, said David Williams in WashingtonExaminer.com. But the health care bill's collapse has created new incentive and pressure on the GOP to show it can pass legislation. In tax reform, the next item on both Trump's and Ryan's agenda, they have the perfect opportunity to get something big done. Lowering and simplifying the absurdly complex corporate and personal income tax code enjoys broad popular support, unlike repealing Obamacare. Trump also has a real passion for tax reform, said Edward Isaac Dover in Politico.com. And last week's embarrassing failure could be just the shock to the system that Republicans need in order to start working together. We'll see, said Catherine Rampell in WashingtonPost.com. Tax reform involves countless painful trade-offs and angry interest groups who will fight bitterly to protect their own entrenched interests. The issue will also force Republicans to address a core contradiction between the party's long-standing belief in tax cuts for the rich and the blue-collar populism that Trump rode into the White House. Trump says tax reform will be fun, said Ezra Klein in Box.com. He also said repealing Obamacare would be easy. When push came to shove, however, Trump showed neither the detailed grasp of policy nor the patient coalition building that gets bills passed in Washington. This president just may not be capable of the slow, arduous work of governing. Decades ago, a party in control of both Congress and the presidency would have had free rein in pushing through an agenda, said Francis Fukuyama in Politico.com. Powerful committee chairmen and party leaders could use a combination of bribes and threats to bend renegades to their will. But today, pork barrel earmarks have been eliminated, and Freedom Caucus members can rely on outside activist groups for funding instead of the party hierarchy. House and Senate Republicans are far more frightened of primary challenges and their own constituents than they are of Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, or President Trump. It's still early, but Trump's plan to be a powerful and transformative president seems stillborn. It is much more likely that the Trump presidency will continue to hobble along, weakened by its own lack of experience and internal contradictions. It was a good week for Close Encounters. After a new book cataloging UFO sightings found that the greatest number occur in California, with 16,000 between 2001 and 2015. It was a good week for skipping a turn after President Trump turned down an invitation to throw out the ceremonial first pitch at the Washington Nationals' home opener. The White House cited a scheduling conflict, but there was widespread speculation that Trump feared being booed in the heavily Democratic city. And it was a good week for local law enforcement after a judge in Spain dismissed a lawsuit brought by a 15-year-old boy who had accused his mother of mistreatment for taking away his mobile phone. The judge ruled that the parent was well within her rights. But it was a bad week for Bill O'Reilly after the Fox News host mocked U.S. Representative Maxine Waters, saying she appeared to be wearing a James Brown wig. O'Reilly later apologized, calling his comments dumb. It was a bad week for Donnie Ladds after officials in Scotland revealed that just 7 boys born in the country last year were named Donald, the fewest on record. Naming experts say that local unpopularity of President Donald Trump, whose mother was born in Scotland, is the main reason for the name's disfavor. And it was a bad week for premature celebrations after TV ads congratulating Republican lawmakers for successfully replacing Obamacare aired in several states the same day Paul Ryan pulled the bill from the House floor. The ads urged voters to thank their representatives for keeping their promises and providing the better health care you deserve. Before we move on, there's a boring but important short here. Kushner's new task force. President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, will lead a new White House SWAT team aimed at making the federal government run like a business, the Trump administration announced this week. The White House Office of American Innovation will be made up of business executives and consultants who, like Kushner, 36, have no previous government experience. The group will have sweeping authority to modernize and streamline government operations by applying the best ideas from the private sector, White House officials said. I promised the American people I would produce results and apply my ahead-of-schedule, under-budget mentality to the government, Trump said. The role broadens Kushner's portfolio, which also includes brokering Middle East peace. Our briefing page article this week is titled The Bannon Worldview. Former Breitbart boss Steve Bannon wields huge influence in the White House. How does he see the world? What is Bannon's job? As President Trump's chief strategist, he plays a dominant role in crafting and driving the administration's agenda. Bannon co-wrote Trump's startlingly aggressive inauguration speech, portraying America as an economically broken, crime-laden dystopia forsaken by its leaders, helped draw up the controversial travel bans that have been struck down by federal courts, and has become the first ever political appointee to take a permanent seat on the National Security Council. His influence on Trump's thinking is so great that many critics sarcastically refer to him as President Bannon. A self-proclaimed economic nationalist, Bannon, 63, sees himself as a defender of the forgotten white working class and believes the Judeo-Christian values of the U.S. and the West are under attack from secularist Islam and other cultures. There is a major war brewing, he says, a war that's already global. What's his background? Brought up in a pro-union, Democratic Catholic middle-class family in Richmond, Virginia, Bannon joined the Navy after college. It was during his 7 years of service that he first became interested in conservative politics. He saw President Jimmy Carter as weak and ineffective, and greatly admired President Ronald Reagan. After a spell at the Pentagon, when he also studied international relations at Georgetown, Bannon left the Navy, earned an MBA from Harvard Business School, and joined Goldman Sachs. He thrived in the intense world of corporate finance, and after 4 years, set up his own investment firm specializing in media financing. One deal gave him a share of royalties from Seinfeld, a move that proved hugely lucrative when the comedy show became a massive hit. After selling his company, Bannon shifted from financing TV shows to making conservative-focused documentaries such as In the Face of Evil, Reagan's War in Word and Deed. Friends say his outlook grew darker and more Manichaean after the 2001 terrorist attacks, and darker still after the 2008 financial crisis. Why? When the markets plunged, Bannon's father, Marty, panicked and sold his entire life savings of AT&T stocks, losing $100,000. Bannon claims that his father's crushing loss and the fact that no banking executives faced any punishment after the crash cemented his anti-establishment outlook. In the ascendant economy, Silicon Valley, Wall Street, Hollywood, the Marty Bannons of the world were getting washed out to sea, he says. Nobody was paying attention to them. Bannon made documentaries blasting Wall Street banks in Washington, latched onto political insurgents such as Tea Party icon Michelle Bachmann and 2008 vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin, and took over the right-wing anti-establishment website Breitbart.com. A voracious reader, he adopted the generational theory outlined by authors William Strauss and Neil Howe, who argued that history is divided into four recurring 20-year cycles: highs, awakenings, unravelings, and then every 80 years or so, crises like the Civil War and World War II. Bannon thinks the 2008 crash was an unraveling and that a major global crisis is next. What sort of crisis? Bannon outlined his worldview most clearly in a 2014 Vatican conference. He said, "Enlightened capitalism, governed by Judeo-Christian values, has been replaced by a disturbing form of libertarian conservatism, which had turned people into commodities exploited by global elites." At the same time, he said, "Secularism had sapped the strength of the West, leaving it unable or unwilling to fight the rising danger of radical Islam and terrorism." Bannon predicted that these purported societal failures would lead to a global populist revolt against the elites and the political establishment of both major U.S. parties. "We're at the very beginning stages of a very brutal and bloody conflict," he said. In describing that struggle, Bannon cited Jean Raspail's Camp of the Saints, a virulently racist 1973 book in which the white world is overrun by an invasion of desperately poor, dark-skinned immigrants. Bannon recently said the influx of Muslim refugees in Europe was almost a Camp of the Saints-type invasion. What does Bannon propose doing? Bannon believes the only viable path forward is to overthrow the political establishment, undo globalization and restrict immigration, and create a new system based on Judeo-Christian values and economic nationalism. One of his goals in the White House, he said recently, is to deconstruct the administrative state. Even though Bannon transformed Breitbart into an alt-right site peddling overt racism, misogyny, and anti-Semitism, his friends and even former colleagues who have turned against him insist he's personally no bigot. They say he simply uses whatever and whoever he can, Breitbart, the Tea Party, Trump, to pursue his revolutionary goals. Indeed, Bannon last year described Trump as an imperfect vessel for his own views. And Bannon doesn't shy away from his image as a shadowy figure pulling strings. "Darkness is good," he says. "Dick Cheney, Darth Vader, Satan. That's power." And it's time to read a few of the columns. The first comes from the U.S. The title is "Term Limits for the Supreme Court." "It's time to end the Supreme Court lotto," said James Tisch. "Dumb luck dictates currently whether presidents, who serve 8 years at the most, have the power to shape the court and therefore the country for 30 years or more. With rising life expectancy, appointees like 49-year-old Neil Gorsuch could serve on the Supreme Court until 2050. That's bizarre. Lifetime appointments are distorting our democracy in troubling ways, with Democrats and Republicans treating each high court opening as a titanic life-or-death struggle. Last year, Senate Republicans wouldn't even grant a hearing to Obama nominee Merrick Garland for 10 months. Now Gorsuch heads toward a contentious and polarizing Democratic filibuster that could poison the Senate even further, making compromise impossible on a host of crucial issues. There's a simple solution. Limit justices to a single 18-year term and stagger the appointment so that two new justices are nominated in each presidential term. After 18 years, the court would turn over entirely. This plan would reduce partisan infighting and give presidents an incentive to appoint the very best justices in the prime of their careers, while constantly reinvigorating the court and our democracy. No one in America should have a guaranteed job for life. From France, how France took over Europe. Move over, Germany and Britain. France is again emerging as Europe's most important power, said Arnaud Lapermentier. Until the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, we French effectively ran what is now the European Union. Nothing could happen, British joining the common market, enlargement to Spain, without a nod from Paris. But after German reunification came the adoption of the euro, modeled on the Deutsche Bank, Deutsche Mark, and governed by a German-style bank. The economic and social ideals that reigned were German, inflected with elements of Anglo-Saxon neoliberalism. The 2008 financial crisis destroyed all that, and French ideas are once again in vogue. Greece has been bailed out, fiscal austerity has been discredited, a socialist from Luxembourg, Jean-Claude Juncker, leads the European Commission. And we're forcing Apple to pay taxes in Ireland. There is even talk, given President Trump's recent disparagement of NATO, of a European defense union. Many of these changes were initiated by President François Hollande. Some even date to the presidency of Nicolas Sarkozy. There, it's almost like the end of the 19th century again, when France was not militarily and economically dominant, but retained its intellectual and cultural prestige and diffused its ideas. Once Europe's economic recovery is complete, French power will be reaffirmed. And this from Saudi Arabia. U.S. ditches centuries of precedent. Letting Americans sue Saudi Arabia over 9/11 is a disastrous mistake, said Salman al-Dursari. Families of 850 people who died and another 1,500 who were injured on that ill-fated day have filed a federal lawsuit against the kingdom, claiming that Saudi Arabia provided financial, practical, and material support to al-Qaeda for years leading up to the attacks. The suit was made possible by the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, JASTA, a U.S. law that specifically allows Americans to sue foreign governments. The kingdom doesn't fear the verdict. Although 15 of the 19 attackers were from Saudi Arabia, for almost two decades, no judiciary body or U.S. intelligence has found proof of Saudi government involvement in the attacks. And al-Qaeda itself has declared the Saudi government to be its biggest enemy, and even tried to assassinate Crown Prince Mohammed bin Nayef. Still, the kingdom strongly opposes JASTA, because the law muddles all relations shared by the international community. Countries relate to one another based on principles of equality and sovereign immunity. Remove that immunity, and we'll see a mushroom effect of litigation all over the world, including against U.S. soldiers. The U.S. surely does not want such a mess. Our last word feature this week is titled Swallowed by the Sea. Rising sea levels are submerging two American island communities. Their residents now face a choice, said reporters Carolyn Beeler and Molly Peterson. Stay and fight the ocean or move away. To stay or to go. It's a wrenching question low-lying coastal communities around the world are beginning to reckon with as climate change starts to push up global sea levels. But it's not just happening in faraway places like Bangladesh or the Maldives. It's happening right here in the U.S. On Tanger Island, Virginia, in the southern Chesapeake Bay, residents are facing the inundation of a place some local families have called home since the 1600s. They are determined to stay. On Ile de Jean Charles, on the Louisiana Gulf Coast, a disappearing Native American community has made the opposite decision. They are the first community to receive federal money to relocate because of climate change. It's a tale of two towns confronting a decision no community would ever want to make, but that more and more will have to. Tanger, in the broad open water of the Chesapeake, about halfway between Washington, D.C. and Norfolk, Virginia, is reachable only by boat, and its isolation makes for a very tightly knit community. I like the family, said Tanger resident Teresa Vermeil Tyler. The people, they grew up with each other, so it's not just that they're each other's neighbors, they're family. You can't beat it when it comes to raising kids. Like most of Tanger's roughly 450 residents, Tyler uses a golf cart instead of a car to get around. She waves her nods at neighbors as she navigates gravel roads lined with white picket fences. Many of the island's men make a living catching crabs and oysters on the water beyond, long a key part of the Tanger identity. We've been working the waters for a couple hundred years now, said James Ucker Eskridge, Tanger's mayor and a waterman himself. But the relationship with the water is becoming more fraught. The Chesapeake Bay, which has been providing the resource for a living on the island, is now threatening the island, Eskridge said. Threatening is an understatement. The average elevation on Tanger is only about 3.5 feet above sea level, and the bay is slowly but steadily washing the island away. Today, it's only about one-third the size it was in the 1850s. It's a complex problem. Climate change is pushing sea levels up around the world, but the waters of the Atlantic along this part of eastern North America are rising faster than the global average because of changes in the Gulf Stream. Meanwhile, the land in the southern Chesapeake Bay has been slowly sinking for thousands of years. The combination of rising water and sinking land has added up to more than 1.5 inches of relative sea level rise per decade since the mid-20th century, and it's speeding up. By 2100, the Army Corps of Engineers projects the water surrounding Tanger Island will rise as much as 6 feet more, leaving all but the highest points of the island underwater. But the ghosts of lost land are already visible here. Out on the water in a drizzly afternoon, Eskridge stopped his crab boat about 100 yards offshore, over a spot where there used to be a town. They had a small schoolhouse and a small store up here, Eskridge said, gesturing out to the open water. All of it's underwater now. The last families evacuated this part of the island in the early 1900s, but residents left the graves of some of their ancestors behind. Two tombstones stand on the marshy shore of the island, just a few feet away from the lapping waves. Eskridge recovered the bones of one of his ancestors before they could be swept into the bay and reburied them on high ground in the middle of town. It's very discouraging when you look at it, Eskridge said. We are now on Tanger. We don't have another island to jump to, so we've got to protect the one we're on. Dozens of inhabited islands in the Chesapeake Bay have washed away since the Europeans first settled the region in the 1600s. The residents of Tangier know history stands against them, but they are firm in their resolve. We won't help. We don't want to leave, said Tyler. This is a family, and we don't want to leave each other. The reasons Tangier's residents are dead set on staying are a complex web of faith, politics, and tradition. It's a very conservative community, and many residents say they will live on Tangier as long as God wants them to. It's all on his timetable, said resident George Cannon, when asked how long he thought Tangier would be around. Meanwhile, most don't accept the science of man-made climate change, that pollution is causing global temperatures and sea levels to rise. What's causing the rapid threat of their shoreline, they say, is simple erosion. We don't have no marshes to absorb the water anymore, said longtime Tangier resident Lonnie Miller. He can't see the overall level of or the water rising, but he can see waves eating away at the edges of the island. So we are going to get more street tides on the street, Miller asked. Yes, but is it global warming? No. More than 1,000 miles southwest of Tangier, a similar combination of rising water and sinking land is buffeting another community with long ties to their patch of earth. Where I was born at and raised at, you can't walk there anymore, said Albert Nakin, chief of the Biloxi Chittimacha Choctaw tribe, which is called Louisiana's Ile de Jean Charles, southwest of New Orleans, home for 200 years. You sink up to your knees if you walk there because it's so saturated with water. As on Tangier Island, the changes here are complex. There's climate change and global sea level rise, but there's also subsidence. Dams on the Mississippi River have bottled up silt that used to replenish the land here. Oil and gas canals have cut up the marshes. Both lead to even more erosion. The U.S. Geological Survey estimates southeastern Louisiana has lost more than 16 square miles of land a year for a quarter century. The combination of these forces resonates in the very name of Ile de Jean Charles. When the Biloxi Chittimacha Choctaw tribe arrived 200 years ago, it wasn't actually an island. It was a peninsula. Today it's a narrow strip of 320 acres, just 2% of its surveyed size 60 years ago. Like the residents of Tangier, Chief Nakin don't believe in human-caused climate change, even after Hurricanes Katrina and Rita in 2005. But he's changed his mind. Now Chief Nakin believes in climate change because, he said, he sees it. Something is happening, he said. What's happening becomes palpable along a skinny hockey stick of a road, the only thing that connects the Ile de Jean Charles to the rest of Terrebonne Parish. It's called Island Road. The water splashes over it at high tide, even though it was rebuilt in 2011, higher and wider at a cost of more than $6 million. In big storms, the water stops the school bus and the postman. Not too long ago, it stopped Chantel Comordel, who grew up on the isle but doesn't live here anymore. My dad turned his truck around, she said, because there were waves crashing on the road. Others in Comordel's family feel the risk, too. When Comordel's 90-year-old grandfather, Wenceslas Belial, fell ill last year, the ambulance couldn't get to his house. When Belial's house is raised 14 feet above soggy land to protect it, and until recently he was intent on staying forever. Now he's not so sure. I don't know how long the people gonna stay over here. I really don't know, he said. Everything been going, fast, go faster and faster. With the eroding wetlands less able to buffer wind and water, storms hit the land that's left harder now, and they're harder to recover from. Still, none of the dangers make it any easier to move upland and inland. Wynn's grandson, Kyle Billiott, remembers how it was in 1985 when his family moved inland after back-to-back hurricanes. He was 9. It was hard for me leaving this place, Kyle said. I don't know if it was just because of the family, but she was always in nature. We swam. Every day we played hide and seek in the woods right there. We always had something to do. Kyle is in his 40s now, and the woods he played in have disappeared, as have the island's basic services. Gas to the island has been disconnected. A big storm could end phone and water service. If the road washes out, the Federal Emergency Management Agency said it won't be replaced. And Louisiana's $10 billion Coastal Master Plan leaves out the Isle de Jean-Charles and a few other communities. They can't save the island, Kyle said. Not that it's a bad place to live. It's just the things you have to deal with living down here. With problems accumulating as fast as their land was disappearing, the Biloxi, Chitimaca, Choctaw tribe finally took the chance to apply for a special federal grant to help threatened coastal communities. In 2015, the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development awarded the Isle de Jean-Charles community $48 million to move inland. It's the first federal tax money ever earmarked specifically to move a whole community because of climate change. The timetable for the move is still unclear, as is the tribe's destination. And some tribal members, including some in the Billiutt family, are skeptical the plan will ever actually come together. But the HUD award is nourishing the hope that even as their home disappears, the tribe can stick together. We need to find something that really works and do it, and not just put Band-Aids here and there, said Cummerdell. We're going to try to do whatever we can to save our people. The residents of Tanger Island feel just the same, but imagine a very different path forward. It starts with the stone jetty to protect part of Tanger's harbor, which the Army Corps of Engineers agreed to build in 2018 after years of lobbying by residents and their allies. But that won't protect the whole island. Residents want a seawall built around all of Tanger, like one that now protects the island's airstrip and sewage system. An Army Corps marine biologist has also sketched out an even more ambitious $20 million to $30 million plan to build offshore breakwaters and dunes, fill in marshy parts of the island with dredged sand, and plant trees on the new land. As of now, the plan is merely hypothetical. No one is talking about financing the project. And without this kind of elaborate engineering solution, the Corps says, the town will likely need to be abandoned within 25 to 50 years. And even with it, life in Tanger's main village might only be extended by about 50 years. Which raises the question, what's it worth to extend the life of a disappearing community, and who would pay for it? Despite the Louisiana grant, there's still no federal plan for saving low-lying communities, no uniform way to decide which to protect and which to abandon. But Biloxi Chitimaca Choctaw Chief Albert hopes the process of his tribe's relocation might serve as a starting point. His community has already shared its experience with people from threatened parts of Alaska, as well as coastal communities overseas in Indonesia and the Marshall Islands. Our island is a cancer, Chief Albert said. It's being eaten away. But we are doctors. I want to show them how it's done. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in PRI.org. We'll move over to the health and science page. First article, sleeping well is the best revenge. Improving the quality of your sleep can make you feel as good as winning the lottery, a new study suggests. British researchers analyzed the slumber patterns of more than 30,500 people over the course of 4 years and found those who made positive changes in their sleep habits were significantly happier and healthier. In fact, researchers said the mental and physical advantages of better sleep were similar to improvements observed in Britain in British lottery winners 2 years after they'd hit a $250,000 jackpot, report ScienceDaily.com. The researchers note that while people who slept longer registered higher scores on mental health tests, it didn't necessarily boost their physical health. Better sleep quality, however, had a salutary effect on mind and body alike. On the other hand, sleeping poorly and relying on sleeping pills to get rest correlated to worse physical and emotional health. It's estimated that more than one-third of adults in the U.S. don't get enough sleep, which puts them at higher risk of developing diabetes, obesity, depression, and other chronic health issues. More research is needed on how sleep affects long-term quality of life, the scientists said, but the evidence does suggest it's important. We are far from demonstrating a causal relationship, said lead author Nicole Tang, but the current findings suggest that a positive change in sleep is linked to better physical and mental well-being further down the line. And the health scare of the week, GPS turns off brain. Relying too much on your GPS could deactivate parts of the brain, a new study suggests. Neuroscientists at University College London scanned the brains of 24 people as they navigated simulations of the British capital. Sometimes they had to find their own way, and sometimes they were given turn-by-turn directions, similar to those offered by sat-nav systems. Activity in the hippocampus, the brain region involved in memory and spatial mapping, increased when the participants navigated by themselves. It also stimulated their prefrontal cortex, which is involved in planning and decision-making. But when participants were given GPS-like directions, brain activity in those regions switched off, reports Scientific American. This shift could free up mental resources for other tasks, but researchers note that over time, the brain's ability to navigate could suffer. If you think about the brain as a muscle, said study leader Hugo Spears, then certain activities, like learning maps of London streets, are like bodybuilding. And we're over on the Talking Points page now. We'll read a couple of these articles. We'll start with the one that says, Trump, does truth no longer matter? President Trump's contempt for the truth has become his defining feature, said Will Oramus in Slate.com, shaping everything from how he talks to the views he holds. Just read Trump's mind-boggling interview in Time's latest cover story, Is Truth Dead? Asked to explain the countless falsehoods he has uttered over the past 2 years, Trump shrugs off all responsibility. His claim that President Obama wiretapped his Trump Tower phone? He didn't mean the wiretapping part literally. It was just a good description, he says. What about his baseless accusation that Ted Cruz's father was linked to JFK's assassin? I'm just quoting the newspaper, he says, referring to the National Enquirer. Generally, Trump says he follows his gut instinct, and my instinct turns out to be right, adding, hey, look, I can't be doing so badly because I'm president, and you're not. The Time interview is a particularly helpful document, said Lawrence Douglas in TheGuardian.com. It provides a guide to the Orwellian Trump speak now distorting our national discourse. In Trump speak, a speaker can never be accused of lying if he's simply repeating the statements of others, even if the original source is a supermarket tabloid or a Fox News phony expert. In Trump speak, a statement need not be completely accurate. Close and maybe are good enough. Most importantly, if his supporters continue to cheer him, then what he's saying must be true. Hey, I went to Kentucky 2 nights ago, he says, as proof. We had 25,000 people. Trump's comments also prove how the president's mind really works, said Michael Shear in the New York Times. Underneath his grandiose self-belief lies a crushing fear that he's not smart or good enough, and that his critics know it. Hence the repeated bitter references to those who laughed at his campaign. But Trump's closing statement, "I'm president and you're not," is most telling of all. To him, his victory in November stands as the ultimate vindication of his lying. The trouble for Trump, says Yoni Applebaum in TheAtlantic.com, is that sooner or later the truth catches up. When he was a TV personality and gossip page star, his lies and exaggerations were entertaining. But now his decisions affect Americans' everyday lives, as well as the entire world. And bluster and BS won't get it done. Not even an emperor can prevent his subjects from noticing he has no clothes. Obamacare. Will it collapse on its own? Now that the GOP's health care bill has crashed and burned, President Trump has a massive decision to make, said Jordan Weissman in Slate.com. What to do with Obamacare? Trump has said that when the Affordable Care Act explodes, Democrats will be eager to strike a deal. But the law is unlikely to collapse under its own weight. While the reluctance of young, healthy people to sign up has prompted several major insurers to pull out, resulting in steep premium increases, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office recently concluded that the system would naturally stabilize in most areas of the country. So if Trump wants Obamacare to fail, he may have to sabotage it. That's easily done. His administration could dramatically reduce enrollment by refusing to enforce the individual mandate. Or the government could drop its defense of Obama-era lawsuit against government payments to insurers, a nuclear option that would almost certainly tear apart the marketplace. Bad idea, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. Trump thinks Democrats will take the blame if Obamacare fails, but he'll be the one in charge when millions of people lose their insurance. Besides, deliberate inaction would shift the onus back onto Republicans to craft an alternative, and the recent fiasco proved they have no idea how to do that. Trump would be much better off trying to improve Obamacare, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. The program has turned out to be remarkably cheap, costing about 33% less than originally expected. If Trump spent a bit more money on subsidies, enrollments would improve and premium prices would drop. He could also revive the idea of a public option, government-run insurance like Medicare, for states with few insurers. That's the only way for Trump to honor his campaign promise about improving health coverage. Don't hold out for a bipartisan kumbaya, said Philip Wegman in the Washington Examiner. Democrats want Trump to seem incompetent, so they won't work with him. Besides, Trump can't enrage conservative lawmakers because he needs them to pass other legislation. Ultimately, Obamacare can be changed and improved, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. But the biggest problem Republicans face is that people who have health insurance like it. The law's central triumph, creating a federal right to access to basic medical care, will never be taken away. Gorsuch, why Democrats may filibuster. A nuclear confrontation is brewing in the Senate over Neil Gorsuch, said Rebecca Berg in RealClearPolitics.com. Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer announced this week he was unimpressed with the federal judge's testimony last week and would seek to filibuster President Trump's Supreme Court nominee. Gorsuch said Schumer almost instinctively favors the powerful over the weak. A filibuster would require 60 votes to end debate and clear the way for confirmation. That's a tall order when Republicans hold a mere 52-48 edge, while Democrats, still seething over the GOP's decision to block Obama nominee Merrick Garland for 10 months, are motivated to obstruct Trump at every turn. If a filibuster happens, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has telegraphed that he will invoke the so-called nuclear option, said Sangmin Kim and Elena Shore in Politico.com. That means changing Senate rules to kill the filibuster, allowing Gorsuch and future high court nominees to advance with a simple 51-vote majority. For the Democrats, filibustering Gorsuch is the right thing to do, said Paul Waldman in the Washington Post. It's not just that he was endorsed by right-wing think tanks and will certainly vote to overturn Roe v. Wade. The larger issue is that the GOP's stonewalling of Garland was a crime against democracy, and Democrats can't let it pass without at least a symbolic protest. Centrists argue the party should be more pragmatic, said Dean Obadala in the DailyBeast.com, and save the filibuster for the loss of a liberal justice such as Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But Democrats need to excite their base for 2018, and a passionate, principled filibuster would be a rallying cry, the Democrats' own version of the Alamo. Schumer is doing the Republicans a favor, said Kevin Williamson in NationalReview.com. Has no substantive case against Gorsuch, who is eminently qualified. But Schumer is giving the GOP a perfectly legitimate reason to suspend the filibuster, and Republicans should change the rules to eliminate it completely, both for Senate, both for Supreme Court appointments and all legislation. Killing the filibuster would mean Democrats couldn't block tax reform and other conservative legislation. With a mercurial president and a Republican caucus charged with making needful but unpopular reforms, GOP control in Washington may be fleeting. Best to make the most of it. And we will finish up with a quote. This comes from Chuck Berry, quoted in Billboard.com. He says, "Don't let the same dog bite you twice." With that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service would like to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.